Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Alex Horston.
Thank you.
Your second novel, mm-hmm. Love After Love. Your first novel was In My House. Mm-hmm. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you so much. Hello.
Love After Love is a poem by Derek Walcott. Mm-hmm. Why is it central?
Well, I mean, obviously, to those who are familiar with the poem, it's actually a poem about a breakup. It's a poem about falling out of love with someone else and rediscovering yourself. So there was a little bit of a contradiction in it, actually. But the reason that I chose it was because it's one of the big questions of the novel, actually. Is Nancy, I mean, obviously, it's a book about an affair. She sincerely believes herself to be in love with another man, and that's why she's making these changes in her life. But one of my questions is actually, how much is it about Adam, her lover, and how much of it is about a moment that's happening in her own life and about her on a personal kind of journey to a different way of living? So that to me, I mean, Adam, her lover, feels that the sentiment that Walcott describes is expressive of his love for her, because being with her brings him to himself. But I would, if not argue, certainly be willing to discuss the fact that Nancy's journey is as internal as external.
Absolutely what I would say. And I would say that although outwardly she seems central, mm-hmm. and it's important to her to seem central, mm-hmm. as a mother, wife, sister, daughter.
Mm.
Internally, she lives a very different life.
Mm.
I would say also your main character in My House lived, mm-hmm. a very internal life. And to me, she, until circumstances force her, I don't know, maybe through impact,
yeah,
to embody these roles more in less a role capacity, mm-hmm. and in a more actual capacity, mm-hmm. that she really does sort of intellectually embody those roles, and maybe in an egotistical way, mm. needs to be seen to be,
mm.
Carrying those roles, as well as the role of therapist, which, mm. is her job. And again, I don't think she embodies that as much as she thinks she does, mm. until she is forced to.
I think that's true. I think she's someone that lives far too much in her head, and she thinks she sees everything. Actually, as we come to discover, she sees nearly everything wrong. But she, one of the accusations that has been levelled at her as a character, which I knew, is that she's a narcissist, she doesn't feel enough. There's something in that, but I see her as actually a woman in crisis. This is not an indulged, spoilt woman wanting to have a cake and eating it. This is a woman who cannot inhabit her life. And yes, she's trying to control everybody. Yes, she's trying to do everything, but she's living none of it. And I think she would have carried on like that forever if, as you say, circumstance and happenstance hadn't forced collision, actually, and things to change. She could have done that. I mean, in the opening of the book, she thinks she can continue to do all of these things. She doesn't have to choose. In fact, she believes she can't choose, which is a very different thing. So, yeah, I mean, part of my ambition for her is to begin to live more validly, which ironically is what her job is about, helping others do so. But she's a woman, to me, in crisis when we meet her, ostensibly has everything and actually has nothing. I mean, it's a very first world problem, but that's what that character embodies, really.
Yeah, I mean, she's going through many motions.
Mm.
But she is more going through the motions than a lived experience. Mm. And yet, when people say it's egotistical, I think we're all guilty. Everything that we see in life is what we imbue it with.
Mm.
We can't really genuinely see things from other people's viewpoint, especially in our daily lives. You know, that's a semi-impossibility, especially with the, when it gets worn down by the mundanities of living. You live stereotypes even within your family. There's the stories that carry on. And yet, you know, I wonder how, because we see, because her lover has known her before she re-meets him. We do see a glimpse of her as a young woman in university. And it doesn't seem like she's changed that much. Like, she hasn't matured in a certain way.
No, I don't think she has. I think she has. I think
she's continued.
Yes, she has. And she's kind of stunted in that mode, in actually the mode, her childhood role. And that's why the relationship with her brother is an interesting one. Because I think what Nancy would argue and what she feels is she... I mean, there's a moment when she describes childhood as land grab, but the kind of idea that very early on we get put in our place in the family narrative and we're the good girl or we're the charming one or we're whatever. And that she, because of David's charisma and his fecklessness, the space left for Nancy was to be kind of the doer and the coper. And she carries a lot of resentment whilst absolutely perpetuating that role, as many of us kind of do. So, you know, her affair really is in many ways just an attempt, as much as a love affair, to just break free of all the places that she finds herself in that moment of life, as a child, as a sibling. And of course, as a parent, because her children are getting older, and her, you know, her love for them is very real and very passionate, but it's also difficult and conflicting. It makes her vulnerable, as you know, it does for many of us. And they're pulling away because they're getting older, and she's needing to find a new way of being at that moment in her life. And Adam comes, kind of remote, you know, with that connection to when she was young, with that sort of moment when it seemed more that there was more to play for. And what he has, I think, is an ease with himself and in the world. He is not... doesn't identify himself in all these kind of complex networks of relationships. He has no children. He has a wife and a mother who is a completely different kind of mother, a mother that has let him be free. And he's floating through life in a completely different way to Nancy, and that's very much part of his appeal, I think.
Yeah, he has a presence that her brother sort of flirts with. You know, sort of he's her brother seems like he does, but Adam sort of embodies himself and has a presence that I think she finds very attractive. But it's funny because in her most irresponsible moment, she sort of finally finds responsibility and finally grows up.
I think so. I mean, it's interesting. Did she choose that or was she forced into that? But she gets there. I think so. To me, she gets there.
She does meet herself.
She does.
Like in the poem.
She does meet herself. That's what I hoped for her. But again, you know, different readers reach a different place because some people find it, some people said it's just a horribly sad, you know, it lands in such a horribly sad place, which is so interesting to me because I'm very much of the view that, you know, the reader is as valid an interpreter of this book as I am the writer of it. But I didn't, you know, to me, I feel proud of where she gets to and I feel optimistic for her future, you know, but for some people that place is devastatingly sad.
It is quite as your first book was in my house, quite suspenseful. Because it's, I mean, and it's not as though, you know, I mean, a woman has an affair. It's not a hugely suspenseful idea. And yet it is, because it is a big internal drama. And if you are dismantling the structure of your life, or threatening to dismantle the structure of your life, that is huge. And that is dramatic. Tell me, what is that? What's the appeal in that for you?
Well, you're absolutely right, and that is, I'm glad for you to say that, because that that was my ambition actually in both of my novels, because I'm so interested in all the intense inner stuff that we've been talking about, but also a novel needs propulsion and stuff in stuff needs to happen, in my view. So what I've tried to do is enable stuff to happen, you know, with collective people to turn up, you know, the door opens, who's all that kind of plotty propulsion to drive people through in order to give space and time for the internal stuff as well. Because, you know, to write a totally internal novel becomes something different. And what my aim is to create something, readable is a difficult term, something with, I'm going to stick with propulsive, that I want to know what happens next. Things do happen, things happening on the page, but the other stuff, the stuff about identity, motherhood, you know, self, all of those questions are there with a certain lightness, I hope, and you know, just an integrity, just that I can get the bigger themes and the stuff that happens working in synergy, but that's what I'm aiming to do.
In both novels, family relationships, there's a series of angry men.
Yes, there are, yeah.
Talk to me about those things that you're trying to explore in there.
Well, what someone said, I think about the first novel, that my theme was the difficulty of other people, and and I really like that, and I hadn't thought of that, and I thought, do you know what it is? And that's what I'm interested in, because the heart wants, to paraphrase, what the heart wants. But for societies to succeed and for us to ever live alongside other people, there has to be a suppression of that, and we have to find a way to compromise or suppress or in some way, you know, manage our own needs and wants and desires in order to live with anybody else, whether that's a lover, a parent, a child. And however, this doesn't come without difficulty. And what the novel can do, I think, pretty uniquely versus other kind of art forms, is it can show what we think as well as what we do. Dialogue's hugely important. All that, you know, the filmic stuff is really important. But we can go into people's heads. As soon as we go into people's heads, in my world, we're hearing we're hearing the nasties, the stuff that we're not saying, and that's what I'm interested in, and that's why I fear I will always write unlikable characters because we're hearing what they've chosen not to say.
Yes, and you know, in a lot of your characters, we will always know more than they will know about each other. You know, going on,
we
can imagine them are like, we still know,
yeah,
and they still don't know, and they're still not going to know.
It's the joy of the novel, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So, and tell me, it is the joy of a novel, and you came quite late to starting to write novels. Tell me about your journey to writing.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I was the most bookish child imaginable, a voracious, you know, reading was just always my thing, for all the reasons that people describe, that we've been talking about, that you find yourself, you know, you find thoughts and emotions in a book that you recognise without ever having articulated themselves, you know. And so I was always a reader. I did an English degree, you know, back at the normal age. And then, you know, in the 90s, I got a job in advertising, actually, which a lot of people, it was big in the 90s. I did a couple of internships in publishing. But just then fell as you know, as you do, fell into advertising and did that, you know, for 15 years, still reading, but sucked into a busy London full-time job. And then had my first child, a full-time working mum, and then just had that kind of moment of, hold on, life's running away with me. So we moved out of London down to Sussex, and I did a master's in English, not creative writing. Again, the idea, even then, 12 years ago, the idea of writing would have been as unlikely as someone saying, do you want to go to fly to the moon? It was bizarre. It just felt, I think perhaps...
That
it just
was
felt,
for other people?
It was for other people. And and it felt, you know, it's something that meant so much to me. I just felt I didn't have permission to do it. I wouldn't be able to do it.
It would be presumptuous.
Definitely over, you know, the thing of overreaching. And also, I was working and looking after my kids and just doing. And then we moved and I started doing my, you know, this master's in English. And it was the most life-changing thing to suddenly have space for the first time since I'd left university, you know, space and time. And also, I guess we'd moved to the country. There was fresh air, there was walks, there was physical space as well as mental space. And being back in the library and reading was like, it's just heaven. And kind of like a bolt out of the blue, suddenly, halfway through that, I had an idea for a novel, the first idea I've ever had. And started, you know, and it was started scribbling. I thought, hang on, maybe is there something here? And scribbled more, and I actually did a Faber one-day course and read a page to Andrew O'Hagan, and he was like, yeah, there's something in that. Which actually, the best moment in between now and that remains the best moment.
That was the moment before the hard work.
Exactly, and the disappointment.
That was the ego crushing. Became possible.
It's quite. And then I started. From then, I was going to do a PhD, but I didn't. Instead, I started to write. That novel never saw the light of day. Quite rightly, I hope it never sees the light of day. And In My House was my second attempt. So it was a later life Road to Damascus experience. It really was, you know.
Fantastic. And what would you say to, say, someone who is in the middle of the throes of that busy life and, you know, sort of has that dream?
To write.
How to...
Well, I would honestly say the hardest page is the first page, because it's about giving yourself permission. It's not for huge intellects. It's not for, you know, the tiny few. You just got to start, and the moment that you can begin to see yourself as a writer, that leap is the hardest leap. And once you do that, you begin, and then you've got to keep going. But if you write 500 words a day, my math is terrible, in a year or whatever, you know, you will end up with 80,000 words.
Something like that.
What I'm saying. You know,
it's cumulative.
And they don't have to be the right words, they just have to be words, you know, and you will have to re-edit and you will go back and you will, but it's permission, and then it's tenacity.
And comparatively speaking to any other jobs you've had, senses of satisfaction of just completion of things, or, you know, as a parent, you know, there's an incredible sense of satisfaction and whatever. What's daily, and also at the end of the book, what's...
It's a really good question. I mean, the actual writing process is like no other, and it's incomparable to anything else I've ever done in how immersive it is, and that's what I love about it. I know some people see writing as a kind of expression of ego, but for me it's the absolute loss of ego, and I lose myself, and everything I think and worry about is gone, and I'm in another world, and that for me is the beauty of, that is the beauty of writing.
Which is similar to how you read.
Exactly.
That was a sort of gateway.
You're absolutely right.
And that you become a reader of the story you're creating.
I think you're totally right. And for me, there really are parallels in those things. And it's less about creation than kind of just following a story. And there's nothing like that. But the problem you've also touched upon, the difficulty is the kind of, is how deferred completion is, you know, and there will be times when I just want to go and just do a task, start it and finish it and it's done, and then feel good, and then pour, you know, have my glass of wine, because that, it just goes on and on and out and on, and then there are the edits, and there's never really, you know, the beginning of that Michael Douglas, there's the beginning of the film where she types and she goes ding and she's finished and she lights the one cigarette she allows herself and what is it, Romancing the Stone,
yeah.
She does that. It's and I that was, looks like such a future moment. I've never had the lightest cigarette moment.
Yeah, because as soon as I imagine as soon as you are done and you're just like, oh, thank God, and it's at Faber. Of course, then you want to change it.
You do.
You're like, wait.
You do. And 6 weeks later, the edits are there, and then you're going through those, and then letting it go is a terrible moment. And even now, I'll be like that and think, oh, I should have. Yeah. You know, that never ends. And then by the time you're talking about it, you know, you're already kind of got all the problems of the next one going. So, that's what I miss, is the moment of genuine kind of completion of a task.
Oh, well.
But it's
I suppose you started
life.
That in motherhood as well. You should be used to it by
right.
now.
But you're absolutely right. And, you know, one set of problems is just replaced by a new set.
Well, Alex Horston, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. The book is Love After Love by Faber. For more fascinating women, go to radiogorgeous.com.
Thanks for your time.